Ancient Mystery Rituals 375. Bhishiva Incognito Testing the Generosity of the Pious Brahman. It is sad indeed that human souls should be struck with terror by the proximity of the immortals, that instead of glorying in the nearness of his creator, man should be overcome with foreboding, linking heroes with ill tidings and gods with cataclysms. The guilt that sits heavy on conscience is usually responsible for such uneasiness. Men regard their fellows as fools, and as one mortal to another can satisfactorily explain away their vices. The gods, however, are indefinite quantities, with most acute perceptions and accredited with the power of convicting man by his own words. When Nero brutally caused the murder of Agrippina, his own mother, he faced the world unafraid and drowned his small measure of remorse in his cups. But from that day on he dared not join the processionals of the mysteries or take part in any solemn rite. He feared to approach the gods, for the blood he had shed cried out for vengeance. It is said that upon one occasion, when entering the house of a great patrician, Nero beheld a statue of the goddess Ceres. As he looked, the goddess caused her carven face to take on the features of Agrippina. With a hoarse cry, Caesar covered his face with a fold of his cape and was carried half senseless from the house. Pythagoras was accused by his enemies of being theatrical and purposely creating an atmosphere of mystery about his person. Even after the lapse of nearly 25 centuries, the great sage is still regarded as an impostor simply because he employed dramatic situations for purposes of instruction. Not long ago, when discussing with a rather eminent scholar the strange personality of the Samian martyr, the learned doctor exclaimed, "But why did Pythagoras insist upon speaking behind a curtain so that only his feet were visible, when any one knows that such a procedure is utterly ridiculous? Did he for an instant believe that a few yards of blue silk improved the quality of his thoughts or rendered his erudition more comprehensible to his auditors? All these things were simply a vain show and are enough to convince any educated person that Pythagoras was in reality a philosophic mountebank who dressed up a little knowledge in gilt and tinsel so that it appeared stupendous to a group of gullible followers already convinced that their master was a god. When men really have something to say and are conversant with their subject, they simply and definitely set forth their premises and require no such stage props. The man undoubtedly knew something of mathematics and a little of music. He also had an acquaintance with several other arts, but in all things he was simply a superficial observer dependent for his influence and power upon the magnetism of his own personality and carefully staged miracles. We early discovered that the so-called learned of today are incapable of appreciating ancient standards of culture, that they are far too brusque to sense or respond to the subtleties employed by the greater exponents of Greek metaphysics. The veil of Pythagoras is a constant reminder of the fact that if the senses are united in the contemplation of externals, the nature is not free for the rational digestion of internals. He who saw Pythagoras could never know Pythagoras, for he was not to be recognized by the outer senses but rather to be realized by the inner perceptions. If those listening to his words had seen the master, they would have believed the words to have been his own and to have issued from mortal mouth. But unable to watch the movements of the man's lips, the words seemingly issued from behind a mystery and could thus be totally dissociated from the personality of the speaker. The human mind skips lightly over what it does not see, and though all who gathered there realized that Pythagoras was speaking the words, the fact that they could not actually see him do this caused them to regard the words almost as unnecessary. spoken. The veil itself was the symbol of Pythagoras the man, for the human nature is but a drape concealing an inner and most transcendent part. When men desire to isolate themselves from all external stimuli, they have but to still by the power of the will the action of the outer senses. Close your eyes, and the world of forms disappears, close your ears, and the world of sounds ceases to be. Veil an object and the object itself is no longer. 376 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Ancient Mystery Rituals 377. There, for the mind then creates and endows as fancy dictates that which the sense perceptions have not dimensionalized. Pythagoras desired his disciples to realize that the words issued not from him but from the great mystery which he had penetrated in part. He was but as an oracular vase, a sounding urn, or a tinkling cymbal, his mouth but a vent in which a spirit dwelt. It was this inner and invisible agent that spoke. Hence the words that issued therefrom should be regarded as having their origin not in the man but in the rational soul that is above the limitations of the flesh and superior to the dimensionalizing influence of the external senses. Freed from the hypnosis of a personal idolatry, the disciples might thus receive instruction without learning to love the teacher, might understand without seeking to estimate personality, might come to know the truth and not simply the measure of a man. Why, then, did he permit them to see his feet below the veil? The symbolism is again evident. Man's whole nature is a mystery of which only the feet are visible, for the physical body which we perceive and regard as the whole of man is really but the pedal extremities of the soul. He who sees but the visible man sees only the feet of a vast superphysical agent, whose head is of spiritual gold but whose base is of clay. The feet extending beyond the veil reminded the disciple of nature, the visible part of God, whereas the rational and illumined parts that dwells behind the veil separating the visible from the invisible may be known only through the products of the reason. He who saw the feet of the Master had seen Pythagoras, for Pythagoras himself was but the physical extremity of a resplendent invisible nature. According to an ancient adage, men are called by the names given to their feet. The visible physical ichal man to which we assign various nomenclatures is but an insignificant appendage of a nameless reality which, dwelling behind a veil, may never be known until we have learned to esteem the invisible above the visible and consciousness above form. After successfully passing the tests of the lesser rites, the Pythagorean neophyte was permitted to step behind the veil. 378 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. And behold the face of the Master, for it was presumed that, having completed his preparatory instruction, the advanced disciple could look upon the inferior nature without mistaking it for the rational power dwelling within and behind it. Pythagoras was not only philosophic, he was also scientific. In his use of symbols and rituals, he attained ends which modern education utterly fails to attain, because he employed not dramatic but divine procedures in the accomplishment of spiritual education. Today the value of an idea is determined by the relative culture and prestige of its author. In antiquity, however, the culture and prestige of a thinker was measured solely by the quality of his ideas. In other words, a man's thoughts were not considered good because he was great, he was considered great because his thoughts were good. The highest authority of the modern world is the modern world itself, and by that criterion the modern world justifies its works. The highest authority of the ancient world was truth, and antiquity Jews defied its survival by expending its energy in the quest for truth. No man can learn the truth unless he has the correct Rationale of approach. In great measure, this attitude is the outgrowth of atmosphere, and atmosphere can sometimes be created by a dramatic flourish. Yet is there not a science of atmospheres? Do we not declare that the color of wallpaper affect our moods? Do we not instinctively feel more optimistic when the sun shines than when it rains? Are we not at one time elated and at another time cast down by environmental trivialities? Does not our entire mental constitution reflect the state of our disposition, and are we not more susceptible to instruction when in one state than in another? Is it not therefore legitimate to increase our efficiency by creating those mental atmospheres which most effectively stimulate and directionalize our rationality? From this point of view, a veil of underscore blue silk, though to the superficial an absurdity, might become, when employed by one versed in the profounder aspects of the mind, a definite aid to the student's understanding, and consequently serve a justifiable end. Ancient Mystery Rituals 379. What has been said of the blue veil applies equally to all forms of ritualism. When rituals are designed and executed by the uninformed, they are meaningless and grotesque. When created according to definite philosophic principles and formed with a knowledge of the transcendental arts, these very rites become alive and have resident within their own natures a virtue capable of being transmitted to an assemblage. We have lost the art of ritualism, the science of divine dramatics. Yet in the dissemination of philosophic verities, it is often necessary to resort to figures and symbols to convey those subtle facts incommunicable by any literal method. The only reason men demand that the statement be direct and simple is that they ignore those elements of life which cannot be stated directly. The great arcanum perpetuated through the ages by diverse means depended upon ceremonial and processional for the exposition of certain principles, particularly those concerned with aesthetics. The crassness of our present attitude is largely responsible for the disregard for ritualism that exists in our national life. We do not necessarily refer to the somber rituals of the church, which are all too often depressing and inhibiting, but rather to those racial ceremonies and processionals with which ancient nations were wont to express the composite ideals of an entire nation through exhibitions of grace, rhythm, and beauty. Niebuhr observes that the ancients never founded their tragedies on real, but on mythical history only. What were the myths? Simply the outer veils of the mysteries that part, which, though revealed, remained comparatively meaningless until the allegories were unlocked by the philosophic keys. It remained for Christendom to inextricably confuse the issues of mythology and history, causing the former to take on the substance of the latter and thereby lose all semblance to its own true nature. The early church recognized, however, the peculiar efficacy of the pagan ceremonials as evidenced by the introduction of the mystery plays, for on the steps of the cathedrals even during the Middle Ages it was customary to enact episodes from the lives of Jesus and the 12 apostles.